Oh, I like to do things on time, and sometimes time just gets away from you. We have a number of bills tonight. Most of those are fairly straightforward. I do want to try to accommodate. We have a Representative Kahn bill that we made kind of a quick decision this afternoon. Actually, it's already part of a policy bill, but it's her desire, and I think it makes sense to be able to move it quicker. So we can move to that one fairly quickly. But in the meantime, Representative Eakin, would you like to do your bill? Go ahead and do yours. Representative Eakin, welcome to your committee, and would you like to move your bill?
Yes. I'd like to move House File 2344 for possible inclusion in the omnibus health bill.
Representative Eakin moves House File 2344 for possible inclusion, a nice high bill number.
Yes.
Representative Eakin, to your bill. Now, there is an amendment in our packet. Do you want to pass that as well?
There is an amendment, yes.
Okay. Representative Eakin moves the A1 amendment. Would you explain the amendment, please?
Sure. On page 1, line 11, after facility, insert, and an 80-bed nursing facility. And this is to include the Twin Valley Living Center in the legislation, as well as the Halsted Living Center for the rate increase.
Representative Eakin moves the A1 amendment. Explain the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Eakin, to your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I introduced a bill that would call for a rate increase for the Halsted Living Center and the Twin Valley Living Center. Both of these nursing homes are facing a difficult situation in that they're next to other nursing home facilities that have much higher rates. And as a result, it makes it more difficult for staffing purposes, and it places them at a competitive disadvantage. And I have today the head of the Halsted Living Center and the Twin Valley Living Centers, Kim Tyson of the Halsted Living Center, is with us today, and she's going to provide some testimony, as well as Dwight Fugley, who is from the Twin Valley Living Center.
Hi, guys. My name is Kim Tyson, and thanks for having me here today. I passed out the first little flyer there that has the two matrices on it, and I'll just kind of read through that. When I started there 5 years ago, we have some of the highest pay in the area, which goes to show that that facility and that organization has always viewed its staff as being very important, as well as the care of the residents. In this past 4 years, I've seen us go from some of the highest paid for in the area to some of the lowest. What happened is we are kind of bordering on Minnesota. North Dakota passed legislation a few years ago that provided higher rates for their facilities in North Dakota. Then later on, Moorhead was, because of that reason, they were competing with the facilities across from them in Moorhead. They were, and Breckenridge as well, excuse me. They received metro rates to help them compete with North Dakota. Then right on the other side of me, so I've got Hillsborough on one side, and you can see their rates down below. And then on the other side of me, I have Bridges and Ada. And they have received substantially higher rates, even higher than a lot of the metro facilities. And as you can look down below, you can see how much more per day in income they receive for the care of residents than the Halsted Living Center, which in turn, of course, is spent on staffing, wages, and benefits, and it's made it very difficult for us to compete. Last pay period, I think I spent over 200 hours in overtime and pool, and 4 years ago, I never even used pool. So, and that's not good. We don't like to see that for our residents as well. So I guess I just would ask that you would consider giving the Halsted Living Center the same benefits that Breckenridge and Moorhead received as a border facility, because I experience having to compete with those people as well. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Eakin, do you have another testifier? Or?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dwight Fugley, who is the administrator at Twin Valley Living Center.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Dwight Fugley, and I want to thank you all for allowing us to come before you today and talk about the situation we have out in Norman County with the two facilities, both Halsted and Twin Valley. We've been long-term care providers in the area for the last 50-plus years and have done a lot of things to try and meet the needs of our elderly, and also been the driving force, or the corporation has been the force that has made it possible for us to have assisted living in the Twin Valley and Halsted. But as Kim has said here, the competition for employees is quite fierce in the rural area. And when you are unable to match salaries, and I do agree that salaries aren't everything, but they are what many new employees are looking at is what their salary and benefit package will be. And with the situation we have with Bridges in Ada and the rates that they have, which I believe you've also been passed around showing there are a lot more rates than this. We've taken the high rate and the middle rate and the low rate. And the daily variance for the high is $115.86 per day. The middle is $45.42 a day. And our lowest rates are $29.77 per day. That allows them to provide considerably better salaries than what we are able to provide, and also better benefits. And I guess what we would ask of this committee is to consider making a change in our rates so that we can at least be on a level playing field with the Bridges facility and make it possible for us to compete in the marketplace.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for the testifiers? See no questions. Representative Eakin, do you have any further testimony, or are we ready to move on this?
I'm ready to move, Mr. Chair. Yes.
All right. See no questions. Then I will renew, or Representative Eakin will renew his motion that House File 2344 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll move towards the end here and go House File 1761, Representative Kahn. While Representative Kahn is coming forward, Representative Huntley will move the April 7th and April 8th meeting minutes. Any discussion or correction on the minutes?
Mr. Chair,
Representative
I'm not
Huntley?
Those meetings.
All right, well then, Representative Dean ensures me that he was, and he would love to make that motion. So Representative Dean will make the motion that to move approval of the April 7th and April 8th meeting minutes. Any discussion? See no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion passes. Representative Kahn, I will move House File 1761 to be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Okay.
Representative Kahn, I see you have a DE3 amendment. Is that a...
Yes.
Delete all amendment to get it in shape that you want to testify today?
Yes.
All right. I will move the DE3 delete all amendment. Any discussion on that? See no discussion. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the DE3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Kahn, to your bill as amended.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm very grateful to the committee chair for putting this on the schedule. And the Government Operations Committee was very anxious to move it forward. And Representative Brett, I'm very sorry that I can't bring Specialist Michael Vogt here to testify, because he was one of the most impressive people that we've ever met testifying for the Government Operations Committee. Let me just describe his situation. He was sent... Maybe you better do it. Let me ask Jim Cleary, of course, who worked with Michael on this, about I suddenly forgot which theaters he was in.
Okay.
But he was essentially pulled up, and the question was, when he's called up, he gets into the military insurance issue. And so, but then he was worried about continuing MinCare coverage. He was told, well, when you get back, you'll have this period of delay before you can re-enroll in MinCare. So he was worried about that, and I think part of the other things that got him worried about it was, he, as he said, we got ourselves pregnant on leave at one point. So he was, again, having a baby and that. And so he kept both insurance. So he's paying a small copay for MinCare. The state is paying a very large copay for that. And plus the fact that since he has two insurance coverages, one of the things that anyone who's been in that, the major thing whenever there's a claim is that both start fighting. And so he was in Iraq, and he had to use his telephone time calling to fight with insurance companies. And this was, you were just sitting there gasping and gov up that this was happening. Plus the fact that when he got home, he has combat pay, that the combat pay that you get because he was called up is excluded from state and federal taxation. But MinCare was including it in their coverage coverage. So his premium was going up, and he was even possibly going to be dropped off MinCare for this large salary that he was no longer getting, which is not supposed to be counted for anything. And I think, and government operations, and this is exactly, this section is in the next, the bill that you have later, which has 20, this language is completely covered in the MinCare bill that you have, but the GovOps committee was particularly anxious to move this forward. It actually does. What was so impressive about Michael is that it's not helping him. He just went all this effort to help the people who are coming beyond, after him, and there are people in service right now who are in this conundrum. So maybe Jim Cleary from House Research can correct anything I said wrong.
Yeah, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim Cleary. I'm from House Research. I could just, everything was correct. I could just add a few points, perhaps. Mr. Chairman, the Army Times reports that about a third of people who are in the reserves and National Guard who are being called to active duty actually earn more in the military. And, of course, these would be the people who are at the bottom of the economic ladder in civilian life. In Michael's case, he had just gotten out of school when he got the call that he got the alert that he would be going in 5 months. So he couldn't go out and find a good-paying job as an electrician. Instead, he just went to work for his father until the date that he left. And so he was earning less than his capacity. But it was important to him to stay on MinCare because he was told that if he went off MinCare, when he came back, there would be the waiting period. And he had two small children already, and apparently then three by now. And so it was really important to him to stay on MinCare. There are probably a few other details that we're forgetting,
Mr. Chairman, this is a real win-win because the state saves. He can drop MinCare and get right on it right away. It's good for the person. It's good for the state. The state saves that whole state payment into MinCare, which is much more than the smaller copay he was making.
I have a question for Ms. Schill. The fiscal note we have in front of us now, that does not reflect the delete all amendment, does it?
Mr. Chair, members, no, it does not reflect the delete all.
Do we have an updated fiscal note, or can you give us a...
I do not have an updated fiscal note at this time.
Mr. Cleary, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, it's my understanding that first of all, it's our knowledge that this language came from the Senate, and it was used in the other two bills, House File 1873 and Senate File 1837, which are much longer MinCare bills. But it's my understanding that the Senate preferred this language because the Department of Health was encouraging them to use it because there would be no fiscal cost with this, whereas there would have been a fiscal cost with the way that we had originally drafted it in the House. And so my understanding is there's no fiscal cost with this.
Yeah. If I could get someone from DHS to come up here quick and just quickly touch on it so we have it on the record and Representative Bradley won't be afraid to leave this committee again with the gavel in my hands. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Karen Dusso, DHS. Mr. Chair, committee members, testimony is correct. With the delete all amendment, this language is identical to language in both the Senate companion as well as the health care policy bill and has no fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, Representative Kahn, are you finished with your testimony? The more you talk, the more votes you lose on this committee. So we'll, I will renew my motion then at House File 7. Representative Hunt.
Aren't we going to ask if there's anybody in the audience who wants to testify against this bill?
That would be a good question. I can ask, does anybody wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion and that House File 1761 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, what
Representative Houston.
Thank you. What would people think about the consent calendar?
Representative Kahn?
Chairman, judging by the reaction in the Government Operations Committee when the specialist vote was here, I don't think there would be any problem with this with that motion.
Representative, anybody here sit on the Government Ops Committee?
You know, if it was a problem, then
well, since it is my favorite Democrat representative's bill, Representative Kahn, I'll change my motion to pass House File 1761 as amended and send it to the consent calendar. Seeing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote on that. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion passes. Congratulations, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased that you put me up for this.
Representative Abler.
You want 1294 first, Mr. Chair?
One second here, Representative. I'm trying to... Yes, 1294.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the House of 1294 be included in House File 1161. If that's the right number.
Representative Abler moves that House File 1294 be held over for possible inclusion in the Health Human Service Finance Omnibus. For... Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
For
actual inclusion.
Actual. We'll look for actual.
In House File 1161. There we go. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a question, and maybe I should read the entire section for members. It's a nice recodification, 80 pages. They could kind of just get the context. Maybe not. There was a question about the meaning of one of the sections talking about billing. And there's an amendment I'd like to move. It's the A6 amendment, which would clarify that... if the social worker can find it in their conscience, which they mostly don't, to suggest that people don't keep their appointments to pay something, then that's ethical, but there's no state or private pay fiscal impact of any kind to be borne by the client.
Representative Abler moves the A6 amendment. First, Representative Abler, we have a quick question. Was this bill placed on the table? We're trying to remember here. Did we hear this Friday?
It was just held over... It's laying around the table.
Yes.
All right. So it's officially taken off the table. All right. The A6 amendment then. The A6 amendment is before us. Representative, do you have any further comments on that? Or members, any questions?
Mr. Chair, how many comments do you want?
The more you talk, the more votes you lose, Representative Abler.
I'm done.
Members, any questions to the A6 amendment? All right, seeing no further questions, we'll proceed to vote on the A6 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Abler.
Just got to renew my motion that this bill be included in the House File 1161 omnibus. Licensing omnibus.
Before we get to that, Representative Emmer.
Representative Abler, I'm wondering on page 7, section 9, if you'd agree to an oral amendment. I thought we had discussed this in the licensing subcommittee, and somehow we missed it last Friday. On line 25 and 26, I'd like "and criminal prosecution" taken out.
Let's try to write engrossment, Mr. Chair. So you're on page 9. Okay, so that would make a difference.
I'm on page 7.
Okay.
Section 9 that deals with immunities for board members, board employees, and persons engaged on behalf of the board.
Representative Labor, do you have the...
Yeah, Ms. Kearns, so you're talking about the term criminal prosecution? Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I was talking about. Mr. Chair, Representative Abel.
I got a nod from a head in the audience, and I guess they want to be prosecuted, Mr. Chair. So I think that they would welcome the chance to be prosecuted for criminal acts. So I would call it a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Emmer moves to delete line, let's see here, page 7, line 25, criminal, and line 26, prosecution.
Mr. Chair, I just will add a question of the Representative
Emmer. And, excuse me, and criminal prosecution. Any Representative Abler?
I'm just curious about job security issues on behalf of the author of the amendment. Does this enhance or harm his job more than any other person who might find himself at Mr. Chair, it's a joke. So,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure that the people in my district will reelect me if they know that I'm making sure that we state of
these social workers.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, just one other time. My recollection is this might have showed up on other places in this bill. Could we have, just as a request to someone that does that kind of stuff, to run through it to make sure? I mean, I can do that too, but if there's someone to make sure that that similar language is taken care of other places.
Can we get someone from House Research to comment?
Yeah. Yes. This, Mr. Chair, members, this language is in statute currently in the social work bill, in the social work statutes, but it's only under investigation when you're investigating somebody for violations of rules and practices. I'm not sure if it appears in other professions. I'll check on that for you.
I thought it might appear other places in this bill.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
All right. Any further questions on the Emmer oral amendment? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad we're tough on social workers here in this committee. Tough on crime. That's all. I'd renew my motion that this bill be recommended to pass. We've included the omnibus as amended.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Was this, is this the bill that we had a Dan Larson bill and you had some language about?
No.
That's a different
bill. That's different.
Okay.
Any further questions, members? See no further questions. Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 1294, as amended, be laid over for actual inclusion in House File 1161.
Mr. Chair, the motion would be that it be included. So actually, the motion that it be included in 1161, if I just...
Inclusion, incorporated, wrapped up in a big hug. I don't know what else we call it.
But just so it's clear that this is going to be part of it. Just
right. I think it was clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy. Can I offer a follow-up to a previous question that's not related to a bill in front of this committee? Written in the same pile of bills, and then I'll get to my other bill. There was a question on House File 1840 about physician assistant prescribing, whether it was a written agreement or not, and we did find out that the delegation agreement is different than the internal protocol, and they're both written. So we were right, and justice prevailed once again, Mr. Chair, in this committee. So I'd like to move House File 1935. Be included in the 1161.
All right. Representative Abler moves House File 1935 to be included in House File 1161. Representative Abler, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, the reason it's still before you is that there was some negotiations under being undertaken at FCM. We're keenly involved in it, or keenly interested in hoping that they would come to a good fruition. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to report that they did.
Representative Abler, I just was told that I have to actually take it from the table again. So I'm taking it off the table. It's in front of us. And your motion is to lay it over for inclusion in House File 1161. Lay over House File 1935.
Yeah, House File 1161.
There we go. Now we're
kind of a big group hug and bear thing.
There we go.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
I'd like to move the AO50554 amendment, which, Mr. Chair and members, is a delete all. And it contains the substance of the agreement that came out between the audiologists and hearing aid dispensers. And here to declare the happiness in the valley are the two people who are going to tell you what's in the amendment and the not the existing amendment from before, but what's new about it and what the new areas of agreement are. And they'll walk you through the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Abler moves the 0554 amendment, and testifiers, you want to state your name for the record?
My name is John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Hearing Hearing Healthcare Professionals to kind of just walk through some of the changes. We're not going to go through the whole amendment. So if you start with Section 4, which is on page 2, line 11, you will see a prohibition that is in the audiologist section of the statute. And if you're kind of walking through this closely, audiologists will be found, their provisions are found in 148. And then the hearing aid dispensary sections are located in 153A. And so this is a new prohibition for audiologists. They cannot advertise or hold themselves out as licensed hearing aid dispensers. They're licensed audiologists, not licensed hearing aid dispensers. And we wanted to make sure that there was kind of an even playing field out there. And so they agreed to that provision that we requested.
Thank you, Mr. Tuma. Any questions for Mr. Tuma?
Mr. Chair, there's a whole bunch of
them.
There's a whole bunch of it.
That was my first section.
All right, well, we'll let you continue then. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shirley Forrest, and I'm on the board of directors of the Minnesota Academy of Audiology. And the second change is in Section 5, and it refers to the practical exam, which says that all new applicants for audiology licensure will be required to take the practical exam.
Hold on.
That was part of 153, and also states other conditions under which a currently licensed audiologist would have to take that practical exam. And then there's Section 16, which refers to the consumer protection language for purchasers of hearing aids, that that language was all in 153, and we've moved it over to 148. So it's now in the audiology licensure section.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you
or Mr. Tuma,
Section 16, it specifically refers that hearing aid dispensers, these are the certified individuals, have to comply with sections found in 148, and those are all the consumer protection sections. So as you read, like, Section 17 and a couple of the repealers, you'll see that repealing consumer protection provisions, but they're only repealing them in 153A, and then it refers us back to following all the same consumer protections so that it's uniform for anybody who's buying a hearing aid, whether they're buying it from an audiologist or they're buying it from a hearing aid dispenser. They're going to be under one statute and one set of consumer protection statutes. And these are some, there are some changes in there. For example, there's a 45-day period as opposed to a 30-day period for getting your refund, a fully refunded refund. Those are things that were worked out prior and in prior legislation. So everything is, we feel, uniform for the protection of the consumer, and we think it's good to go.
Members, any questions? Anybody in the audience wish to testify for or against the 0554 amendment? All right, seeing none, no more discussion from members. We'll proceed to vote on the 0554 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? None that passes. Representative Abler, to your bill.
Just a final comment. Mr. Chair, it's, this is, in my view, having done quite a number of these bills, this is the way these licensure acts should be handled, at least in terms of the resolution. It's kind of, sometimes you have to create a position where you vote for or against somebody, and it's better when they can sit down and draw the line where everybody's comfortable. I think that's, in this case, it's quite a good outcome. So I want to thank all the participants and their work. So.
Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, then Representative Abler will renew his motion that to lay over House File 1935 as amended for actual inclusion into House File 1161. Thank you, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have to vote, Mr. Chair?
I don't believe so. I think we were laying them over, Representative Abler, so I don't believe so. Right. The big vote is coming next.
Okay, I look forward to that, Mr. Chair. And can I just offer a word to the audience and other members about the division meeting? Just if you didn't know, it's been canceled for tonight. And if you can get a copy of the draft bill, which is probably not quite the final product just yet, it's up in front of 509, so there's plenty of copies for all. So it will be meeting tomorrow at 4:30. Thanks for the chance for commercial, Mr. Chair.
That'll cost you, Representative Abler. All right. The chair will take off House File 1161. We'll take off the table House File 1161. And let's see. The proper motion is to. Representative Hungley will move House File 1161 as amended be passed and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All right, do we have any discussion on this? This is the omnibus licensing bill, all these bills that we passed the last couple days.
Mr. Chair, are they all in there now?
I believe so, yes. I have a note here also that with this motion, we would also like to have staff make appropriate changes. To make sure all these are included and numbered and put in the right order. Any representative, Wilkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we know net fiscal impact on this at this point? Is it, where are we at?
Michelle, do you have an answer to that?
Members, I have a tally going on with each of the bills. As we entered into committee, I am unclear on a couple of these amendments on what the fiscal impact is. So if you could give me a few minutes, perhaps we could work toward that. At the time we entered committee, there was a cost savings of approximately $226,000 in 06 and roughly that same amount in 07. Those cost savings were to the state government special revenue fund. And if I could have just a minute here.
All right.
Brackets are good.
Representative Wilkin, talk for a minute.
No comment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative,
I think there's going to be some savings on the order of a couple $100,000, and do I get to spend that since it's my bill?
Well, I was wondering if we could wait a few more minutes while that number grow.
Do you have the votes?
Representative Wilkin, that was mean.
Money we're talking about here.
Representative Emmer, you're a lawyer, you can talk.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, as I can gather from the other two fiscal notes that were just agreed to be merged into 1161, we have a cost savings of approximately $531,000, all to the state government special revenue fund, and that's in 06 and roughly that amount in 07 as well.
And he does have credit card payments.
That is, we should note that for the record, that Representative Huntley brought the first
bill I've ever passed to save money.
All right. We're most likely fully informed and ready to vote now. So, Representative Huntley will renew its motion then that House File 1161 as amended be passed and referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Huntley. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Paul,
I'd like to move House File 1873 for possible inclusion in the Health Policy and Finance Omnibus Bill.
Representative Paul moves House File 1873 for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Powell, I see an amendment here. Do you want to take that up now, or?
Certainly, I'd like to move that amendment, and I don't have it in front of me.
Representative Powell moves the A1 amendment.
Yes.
Representative Powell, to your amendment.
This amendment I'm going to have the department speak on the amendment. It does about four things, and they know more about it than I do. I'm just going to present.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Char Sadlak, Department of Human Services. The amendment is basically a technical amendment that adds some clarifications. The first part of it on limitations of choice clarifies that managed care enrollment exemption apply only to non-Medicare private health plans found to be cost effective. This is needed because of Medicare Part D federal program, and so this makes it clear that we don't exclude the Medicare plans from PMAP. The second amendment is basically clarifying language to a cross-reference in another section of Minnesota Care Statute, and the second part of the amendment. And the third and fourth part of the amendment basically just points more specifically to applicable law under those sections. So they're basically technical in nature.
Thank you. Members, any questions on the A1 amendment? No questions? Seeing no questions, we'll proceed to vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Powell, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are sections here that were heard in civil law, and I don't plan on speaking to those. The ones that were in civil law were sections 2, 8, 16, 25, and 26. I'll speak to the balance of the bill. And I'll just go through it section by section, and the department is here to give any further explanation. Section 1 of House File 1873, and again, this is the Department of Human Services policy bill. Section 1 eliminates the health plan's reporting mandate. The governor's health cabinet has suggested this change due to the determination that was unduly burdensome. Section 3 conforms statute to current policy by restoring language inadvertently repealed in rule detailing allowable methods to reduce assets to achieve MA eligibility. Section 4 allows clients to make their spend down payment at the end of the month instead of the 20th of the month. The newly automated health match system will be able to accommodate payments received through the end of the month, whereas the now current manual entry cannot. Sections 5 and 6 aligns the schedules of renewal periods with income verification for MA and Minnesota Care. This assures that all renewal periods will begin with the month of application. Section 7 separates the MA retroactive period from the prospective renewal period, and as in Sections 5 and 6, allows alignment of the renewal periods for MA and Minnesota Care. Section 9 restores the 275% income limit that legislation had been passed in 2003 that had lowered it to 200%. This reduction was not implemented by the DHS due to concerns related to federal maintenance of effort requirements and the potential loss of SCHIP funding. Section 10 proposes that dental providers be excluded from the requirement that they must provide services to those on our state health care programs. Section 11 allows an exemption to GAMC requirement to provide a social security number to people who have well-established religious objections. Section 12 aligns the income calculation for Minnesota Care with the renewal period and the income projections for MA and GAMC. Section 13 allows the commissioner to establish reasonable methods to calculate gross earned and unearned income for Minnesota Care. Section 14 aligns the eligibility date of pregnant women on Minnesota Care with the eligibility date for those on MA. With this proposal, the date would be on the date of conception, not the date of diagnosis. Section 15 provides exceptions already required in federal law from the requirements regarding providing a Social Security number by applicants and enrollees. Section 17 would require state-funded Minnesota Care applicants to apply for other benefits for which they may be entitled. Section 18 would require that new household members be counted in the Minnesota Care household for the first day of the month after the month that the change is reported. Section 19 aligns the begin date of Minnesota Care with that of the MA renewal period so that the renewal periods will begin the month of application. Section 20 changes the income calculation to align with the six-month income projection and the six-month renewals for those on Minnesota Care. Section 21 clarifies the exception to the Minnesota Care four-month insurance barrier related to cost-effective insurance. MA would be excluded under the cost-effective definition. Section 22 provides that insurance barriers related to voluntary disenrollment in Minnesota Care do not apply to enrollees and their families when a family member is called to active military duty. Section 23 aligns statutory language with previous amendments in regards to income and calculations of premiums for those on Minnesota Care. And finally, Section 24 further aligns statutory language with previous amendments concerning Minnesota Care by changing the premium for those at 150% of federal poverty guidelines from and below from $48 per year to $4 per month. And that is the simple explanation of the bill. We'll stand for questions, and again, any questions you may have, the department is here in full force and we'll be able to answer those.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Powell, Section 10, which exempts dentists, isn't this going to make it harder for people in Minnesota Care to find dentists who will treat them? And why are you just exempting dentists and not all other providers from this requirement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell, I'm sure that the department can speak for itself, but I believe that their testimony will be that this may make it a bit easier. And we have with us Mr. Oakberg, will speak to that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, the Assistant Commissioner of Health Care, Department of Human Services. Our assessment, and we've been looking closely at this, along with our Dental Access Advisory Committee, is that this requirement whereby dentists need to see our clients, if they're to see public employees, state employees, no longer has the effect necessary. And in fact, we think that perhaps it may actually increase access. This provision, however, is primarily in concert with Department of Employee Relations effort to develop a more effective and more broad-based network of dentists for state employees. Because one of the problems that we've had with this provision is the fact that a number of our employees have had problems accessing dental services. So at this point, we don't think that we'll have any kind of issue with the access to our clients, yet we think we can improve access to our state employees for dental services. And it's unique to Mr. Huntley. It is very unique to dental area at this point.
Any further questions for the partners at Huntley?
I guess it's a statement, but this was put in there to encourage dentists and other providers to provide care to people on our public programs. The incentive being that state employees have very good health insurance and it pays dentists very well. So while this may help our state employees, I don't see how it can do anything to help people on Minnesota Care.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, at this point, our assessment is that it would not do harm. We think that perhaps we'd develop some better cooperation from dentists in the state if we did lift this provision.
I have a quick question for the department. As I quickly look through the bill and the summary here, there's a lot of talk about eligibility and transactions of eligibility. Is there a fiscal note, or does the department have a statement on the fiscal impact with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, there is no fiscal impact on this bill at this point.
Okay. Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of things that I'm really wondering about. I don't understand. Representative Huntley's question right now is, I think, pertinent, because didn't we originally combine those plans that the dentist would have to take? The dentist who wanted to take state employees would have to take general assistance people on general assistance too, or am I wrong about that? Because of the fact that we couldn't get dentists to take general assistance patients?
Mr. Allenberg.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin, this was done some time ago, not only in the dental area, but also for physicians and for health plans, that they're required to participate in our programs if they're to see public employees. In the case of health plans, if they're to be able to have their commercial license in play. So at one time, it was an appropriate move to try to get dentists to better participate in our programs. But at this point, after looking at this closely, we don't think it has that effect any longer. As I said, we think that perhaps it probably has a negative effect. And so we think that in the case of dental services only, we believe that lifting this requirement would be appropriate at this point.
That's Tim Goodman.
Mr. Chair, that's a pretty general answer, and you haven't told me why you think that this would. Is it because we've got bills before us that don't allow general assistance people to get dental care anymore, or is it because you have some knowledge that dentists have said that they would take the $500 limit regardless of whether or not they had to serve state employees, or are we just trying to protect state employees but not general assistance? I don't understand what you're basing that on. You keep saying the same thing, that the department doesn't believe it, but you don't tell me why.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, again, we have looked at this very carefully. We've had some studies done and determined whether or not, indeed, that this has any impact in terms of increasing access to our clients. And based on that assessment, but more importantly, the reason this has been brought to your attention in this legislation is that we think that this will actually help increase the access to dental services for our state employees. That is the driving factor here, and we don't believe, if the Department of Human Services thought that there would be any kind of negative impact on our clients, we would not support that. At this point, we believe, again, talking to dentists, talking to others, and assessing this various means, that we will not have that kind of negative impact. And so we're comfortable in presenting this. We're also looking at other ways in which we can increase our dental access. In fact, one thing we're working closely on with AppleTree and other dental providers is developing a new model of providing dental services that would provide for a network of dental providers to come together and to maximize the use of hygienists and dental assistants to better serve our clients. So we think that there's other ways in which we can more effectively increase access to dental services than having this 101, it's called Rule 101 requirement for dentists.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I would contend that it is all about making sure that, and that's the noble cause, making sure that state employees can see dentists and have access to dentists, because I know that's a problem. But the answer still is, there's no proof in there that general assistance folks are going to be able to get any dental care, because that was why originally that was put into law. And you said you talked to some dentists. I don't know what that means or who you talked to or who said they would do this, but that's not very good proof in order to change the law here.
I'll take that as a comment. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the last 11 years, have probably been involved in no less than a dozen occasions of trying to do something about dental access. And in every case, really, it seemed like the approach was, well, let's just get a bigger stick. And the bigger stick does not work. I've been in very large meetings with this. The fact of the matter is the dental provider, by and large, is a different kind of business. It's a small business. When you tell them that I must take people and I can't handle the missed appointments, I'm underpaid under my costs, and say, well, if you take one, you have to take up to 10%, or originally it was even 20%, the answer is I'm not going to take any. And what has happened, really, the Rule 101, I think, proved to be counterproductive. Now, the way that has worked well is to recognize that dentists as a whole are very charitable people. They really don't mind servicing. As a matter of fact, if you want to visit a wonderful charitable clinic in Rochester where dentists are volunteering their time, it has been the biggest boost to dental access that we've had by, instead of the big stick, just recognizing that there's a way to do it. In a small business like most of dentists are, to ask them to take a chunk of business that is a loss. I mean, they're actually losing for every one of the medical assistance or public assistance patients that they have. Doesn't work. And then we added to it, even if you take any care of any public employees, that we're going to use a big stick and say you have to. In every case, it's not worked. It just simply hasn't worked, Representative Goodwin. And I think it's time to abandon a big stick approach that doesn't work and recognize that there's a lot better ways to do. And the dental community, through a lot of different initiatives, has been at the table in a very successful kind of way. So I think that removing this a system that's not worked of using big sticks makes an awful lot of sense.
Representative O'Turnbaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think a lot of what I was going to say has been said, but in other words, the dentists aren't providing care anyway, so why make them not provide any care? It just absolutely doesn't make sense. You know, we drive 60, 80 miles to find a possible dentist that will take medical assistance or Minnesota care. And I find it interesting that we know that physicians are taking lower fees, taking uncompensated care, in spite of the policies. And yet when it comes to dentists, we're carving them out and saying they don't have to take a loss like the rest of the medical professions.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions briefly, I think. The first, you didn't go over Section 25 because it's in civil law. That's a limitation. But could you just explain that briefly?
You're going to make me dig in my notes, in fact.
It has to do with the state agency not being liable for costs of a prevailing defendant. Is that common?
I'm not sure it's that's common, but I don't have my notes in front of me there at my seat. However, if I remember correctly, the state is compelled to be a party to those cases. And being that they are compelled to be there, it just didn't seem, I think the department would argue that it just they shouldn't be liable for a prevailing party to share in those costs.
Representative Houston.
That does it. Then I have a question. It's not specifically related to the bill, but I think it's generally related because of the health match and some of the stuff you're doing with eligibility. And then I've had a couple of constituents contact me where they've had a change in income and they've put in that information to the department, but to process that takes 2 or 3 months to process, and then they're billed back, and so if their income has gone up, they get billed back for those 3 months that they got more payment than they should have gotten. Will this health match, if that makes sense, that's happened, will the health match resolve that issue? Will it make it much more efficient that way?
Representative Paul, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I'm going to give it over to the department, but the short answer is yes. They should be able to, a new automated system will work much quicker than manually, what they're doing now is manually, but I'll have the department answer that.
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, Representative Powell is absolutely right. We will rectify that situation with an automated eligibility system.
Okay. I think that's a good thing. Thank you.
Representative Member.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, I just want to point out, and it's not fair because Representative Powell doesn't have his notes with him, but there is a problem with that provision, and unfortunately I wasn't in the civil law committee that addressed it because I would have raised it there, but that suggests, the language says where the state agency is named or intervenes as a party, and somehow they're going to change the law and say that they're never going to be responsible for costs. The way they'd be named, of course, is if they wrongfully denied something and then they lose subsequently, they should be paying costs. The same thing goes for when they intervene and they lose, they should probably be paying costs. But I just thought I'd point that out. I know that Representative Powell's understanding is correct when it comes to the first part of it, is named as a party. But then this intervention, and I don't expect that he's going to know that necessarily.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Paul.
I don't know a lot about it, but it's my understanding that they are compelled to intervene by previous court decisions. They have to, not only if they get sued, but actually if they are drugged to court. They don't have apparently the option to not be a party to it, and I believe that's what
Someone from the
Taylor will be able to answer this.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name from the record and proceed.
My name is Jan Taylor, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Chair, member of the committee, this deals with the situation where in the past this involves litigation where we've paid medical expenses related to an injury. Someone is pursuing a lawsuit because of that injury. And formerly we had a lien on the cause of action to recover medical expenses, but we're now required to independently pursue a claim and we don't have the means to outlay for fees and costs of a prevailing defendant. So that basically is what was behind this provision.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Taylor, since you brought it up, I wasn't going to discuss it tonight because I didn't think this is where we were going to go. But that's the other problem with your bill. Subdivision 9, when it talks about notice, I don't understand why, when the state has all of the resources that the state has and all the resources it can bring to bear on individuals, that we have to change it such that it's everybody else's responsibility to make sure the state gets its job done. And I have a problem with your notice language in Subdivision 9, and I would respectfully disagree with you when it comes to the language that Representative Thiessen brought up. With respect to prevailing party, I mean, you should be treated just like every other party that accesses the judicial system, and you have a lot more lawyers than a lot of the people that are trying to make a claim against you. So I understand where you're coming from, but you and I will just have to agree to disagree.
Ms. Taylor, do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emery, you have us at a disadvantage here at the table. Where are you at in what section?
Representative Emery.
I would never want to have anyone at a disadvantage, Mr. Chair. I am on page 5, starting Subdivision 9, Notice, and carrying over to the top of page 6. And essentially what that's saying is that the state's telling by this statute is telling the world that if there is any claim out there and somebody fails to give the state notice of something, I'm not sure what the repercussion is, but it looks like it could be legal malpractice. And then the state, wrongfully intervenes in a claim or wrongfully denies a claim, then if they lose, they're not responsible for anything. So there's really no risk on the state under that circumstance, and I respectfully would disagree with the way that's set up.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, this actually isn't dealing with a situation where we would deny a claim. You know, we've already paid the medical expenses of the individual, and we're asserting our claim in their cause of action. So, for instance, they're suing for personal injury damages, and we're required to pursue our claim independently, which we do, and we either do it using attorney staff of ours or and intervene or also contract with attorneys in some cases to do that for us. But this notice requirement is a duplication of language that is found in the section that was affected by a Supreme Court decision, and so it basically is just lifting that same notice requirement language and placing it in the assignment of benefits section, which is now the way that we are required to pursue our claim for recovery of medical expenses paid on behalf of individuals.
Mr. Chair,
why
can't you do the lien anymore? I mean, basically doing the lien, you're relying on the individual to do all the work for the state, which and save the money. I'm saving money. Is this the Supreme Court case you're talking about,
Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes, that's correct. It's the Martin decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court that basically requires us to pursue under the assignment of benefits provision, an independent action.
Okay.
Let's see, I have Representative Huntley on my list.
Mr. Chair, I had a question for Commissioner Osberg again. Unfortunately, he's here. He's going to have to answer all our questions about Minnesota Care and all our complaints. But, Commissioner, I've heard on more than one occasion that people lose their job or they change jobs. They don't have health care. They go through their COBRA, and then they are required to not have insurance for 4 months before they can get on Minnesota Care. And I've heard that they have applied during that four-month period when they were without coverage, and that the processing doesn't start until the time that they're actually eligible after the 4 months. And then it takes up to 3 months for that to be processed, so that, in effect, instead of being out of without coverage for 4 months, they can go up to 7 months because of the slowness of the way this process. And will Health Match address that problem?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, we have that time down to within 30 days now. It was 3 months a few months ago, but that no longer is the case. We've been able to catch up in our new applications, and so that there's no longer a three-month waiting period for people to be determined whether or not they're eligible for our program. Health Match certainly is going to allow us to more efficiently determine eligibility on an automated basis. So, yes, it's going to make us much more productive, the counties and the state, much more productive in determining eligibility and to process an application much more quickly than we are able to today. But, indeed, we have gotten that waiting period down to within 30 days, which is the state standard.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I'm certainly glad to hear that. Is it retroactively? I mean, if it takes 30 days to process it, when does the eligibility start? When they apply or when it's determined by the department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, eligibility begins the first of the month after eligibility has been determined and there's been receipt of a premium.
Representative Huntley.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, if Commissioner Osberg, if they applied while they were in that four-month period, let's say after the 3 months without the insurance, if they applied then, would it be expected that they would then start? Or would you process the paperwork while they're really not eligible at that point, knowing they will be eligible in 30 days?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, the policy for Minnesota Care for a household that's applying who's in that four-month barrier, if the worker picks up that application for processing and the household has 30 days or less left of that 4 months, then they will process the application and pen the application for initial premium if they're eligible. At this point, if they have longer than 30 days left, they have more than a month left on their 4 months, they would deny that application. A letter does go out to those folks saying, you're in this 4 month wait, you know, call us at this point in time so that we can pick up your application again. What Health Match will allow us to do more efficiently is reactivate that application that's already been loaded, so we won't have those paper file back and forth. So we will be able to do a much better job of getting those folks on at the first possible point that they could enroll.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. On Section 20, where you're changing it to, say, a six-month period, that the income level, gross income level, is $25,000 for a six-month period, and current law says $50,000 for an annual income is the cutoff. Then, prospectively, somebody could have an income of $25,000 during a six-month period, but only have $10,000 in the other six-month period. For example, if they were in seasonal work or something like that, and they could be cut off if they were more than $25,000 in a six-month period, where now you're using the annual amount you will be using the six-month amount. So if they make more than $25,000 in their season, whatever it is, then the season ends and they make a lot less or are on unemployment or whatever the case might be, they will be cut off of Minnesota Care. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Section 20 is tied in also with Section 12, and both of those sections would change the Minnesota Care income projection to a six-month projection. I think that you're correct in your statement that if someone were seasonally employed and the 6 months that we are looking at are the exact 6 months in which they are employed, certainly their income might be higher. However, if part of those months they're employed, part they are not employed, the results are going to be different based on individual circumstances. There are going to be households that benefit from looking at a six-month projection and households that conversely would not. At this point in time, we look at an annual income projection, which is a very difficult thing to project, especially for people who are sporadically working, temporary working, to try and figure out what their income is going to be 8, 9, 10 months out. So we believe that the six-month income projection, which is the same projection that's currently used for MA and GAMC, is in fact going to be more specific, it's going to be more accurate, and it's going to be more fair for people, especially those who do have varying work schedules.
I Representative Paul, I don't see how that can be true. That's going to especially affect people in the rural areas and the tourist industries and the areas where they don't have any health insurance. They don't have that option whatsoever. They're working for small employers. The only thing they have is Minnesota Care, and now they are going to lose that Minnesota Care when they are when they've made a little more than $25,000 and made the majority of their annual income during the tourist season or whatever. So this is definitely, this bill, I think, definitely needs a fiscal note, because I can't see any way this cannot have a fiscal impact. I also have a question about Section 25. Section 23, sliding fee scale to determine percentage of monthly gross individual or family income. How does that affect, what are you trying to do there?
Representative Powell?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in Section 23, and this section is tied in with 12 and 24, it's also with regard to six-month projection of income. I believe it's Section 12, it amends the definition of gross individual and family income to specifically refer to a six-month period of time. Here in Section 23, we're also using the term individual or gross income. We wanted to make sure that it was clear that the premium is based on a monthly income. It is currently, and it shall remain so. So this is just a language cleanup.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and then I just have a question. Almost every one of these sections, you have a date of March 1st or upon Health Match implementation. Now, Health Match is that, again, that contract we have with that company in Arizona that has a lot of their work being done in India. And I understand that Health Match implementation for that $16 million contract was supposed to happen in 2005. And now there has been, just recently in February, I believe, an extension of that contract. We're paying all this money for this contract, and we're not getting the product and the time it was promised?
Mr. Osberg, Representative Paul?
Well, I'll let the department answer that, but Representative Goodwin, I believe that as they looked into this project, it was originally for Minnesota Care, but as they looked at it, they determined that, well, we're going to have to do it for all our health care programs because of all the moving in and out of clients. That was one thing that has, I believe, set this, has added time to this. I'll let the department answer as well.
Mr. Osborne.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin. It's a $13 million contract, and right, we are expecting to finish this next year. It's also a function of what happens in this legislative session, of course, as we look at various changes. But it is an extensive change. The Health Match system is going to allow us to automate, in essence, our eligibility system to a way in which there's greater efficiency, better program integrity, and better customer service to our clients. I mean, we have the most complex, probably complex set of programs in this country. We have 14,000 eligibility rules.
Mr. Chair.
And it is a very complicated set of changes that have to be done. And there's very limited scope of the vendor in terms of what they do offshore. They do some programming, programming of code for us, and that's very limited. And that will not be the case in the next phase of Health Match. They will not have offshore programming done at that point. So we feel that, yes, it has been delayed, but we believe that we're on track to develop a very strong product.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I have the Health Match contract in my office. I'll be happy to share that with members of the committee. But the original contract is a $16 million contract. And the original expiration date, I believe, was sometime this year, and you didn't answer that for me yet, or you didn't answer whether or not in February there was an extension of that contract because the contractor wasn't where he should have been at the point that he agreed to in the contract.
Now, I'm going to ask my project manager to come down here and help me with the technical part of this, but I don't believe we had an official extension of the contract, or did we, Ms.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Davis-Johnson with DHS HealthNet Project. The original contract that we had was for $13,029,532. We have subsequently authorized a contract amendment, you're correct, that has increased that contract, so we are now at a total dollar amount of $15,451,264. This is a performance-based contract, not time and materials, which means that we hold the vendor responsible for producing exactly what we need. So some of these delays are related to us refusing to accept quality that doesn't meet our standards, which I see as a good thing. Part of the contract amendment did indeed push out the implementation date because we were a little optimistic and only thought we'd be done with this. So yes, we did extend our date to, let's see, we extended that till December 31st, 2006 in this original amendment. Subsequent to that, there's been additional discussion about increasing scope so that we can better serve our citizens, and we are currently evaluating a second extension of the date. However, that will not increase that will not increase dollars unless there's an increase to what we're requiring the vendor to provide.
Mr. Chair, I just think this is a good example on something we all need to watch if we care about state dollars and how they're being spent, because there was an agreement with the contractor originally. The contractor, if he wants 13-some million dollars, should be able to complete the project. We shouldn't have to send these jobs overseas with the tax dollars that go with them. And now we're increasing the time. This happens all the time. We're increasing the time another year. We're putting amendments on the contract to allow the contractor to collect more money than the original huge amount that he was asking for. And you're leaving the other bidders behind who would bid on a contract like this for maybe less money in the first place. So these change orders and amendments are currently constantly put on these. We don't know. I'll be real surprised to see what this actually costs us at the end, and I can guarantee you it'll be more than $15,500,000, and we won't get it when it's promised, and there will have to be changes made to it, and that does not count the cost through DHS.
Mr. Chair. Representative Goodwin, I haven't got it. You said you had one. I would love a copy.
Be happy.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Goodwin, I haven't seen any kind of project of this magnitude, whether it be private sector or public sector, that ever got done on time. They always have change orders. The change orders cost money. It's just like when you build a house and you decide you want to move a wall and do anything different. You're going to have change orders in part because of what we do here. They're going to have change orders because of what we passed this year. Any minor change to the program, any rule change, and that costs money. And to kind of imply that somehow it should go to a different contractor, if you want to cost the state money, switch contractors for change orders. I can guarantee you, you're going to be paying through the nose because they don't know the architecture. They're going to have to spend time learning the architecture and all the ways that the things are set up in order to make that minor change, whereas the the contractor that we have now can make it in fairly efficient means.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Paul.
And I would add that, and I think one of the, where I would fault the department is that I don't believe this committee has gotten a full airing of health now. And maybe that's where all the questions are coming from.
Right.
But the second thing is, going back to Representative Huntley's question about determination of eligibilities and incomes and why it takes so long. The information we have is that eligibility determination under Health Match, once it's implemented, could be 30 seconds. And within 24 hours, the applicant can be notified whether they have been approved or not. And I think we would all agree that that would be an improvement over what we have now. Now, when it comes to the fiscal note side, I would think that that would save us money. But apparently this bill doesn't have a, it isn't contained here. But I would think that efficiencies like that would be something that we'd want to see.
Representative Trimba, I have you on my list.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on Section 3, it's page 3, line 13 plus. When I'm reading this, it looks like if you have these assets, you can designate up to $1,500 for each applicant for a burial policy. What if they already have a burial policy? Do they then have to spend down to that $1,500, or are they able to keep their entire burial policy?
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Return, but nobody here at the table knows. We're going to have to call somebody down. Here we go.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Kim Carlin from the Department of Human Services. Could you repeat the question for me?
In the bill, it talks about eligibility, and one of the pieces of spending down is that they can designate burial funds for all of the members of the family up to $1,500. Mm-hmm. My question is if they already have a burial fund that's worth $6,000, where it's probably more likely to be that amount than less in a funeral fund, do they have to spend that burial fund down to $1,500?
Mr. Chair, Representatives,
the
burial fund exclusion is $1,500. It works primarily if there aren't already funds set aside. So it kind of depends on the makeup of the assets that they have. It may be that $1,500 is excluded and other assets in that fund that you described may be unavailable and so not counted. So it depends on what the fund is.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Motrema.
In other words, if they have a burial fund that is only accessible upon death, they can keep that?
There are, Mr. Chair, Representative, there are different ways you can use the burial fund exclusion. And I don't have it right in front of me. It's kind of a list. If you have this, this counts. And if not, then you have this and so forth. There's also an exclusion for burial space items as well. I believe that it's life insurance that's used first, looking at the cash surrender value of life insurance.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Ms. Harlan.
Excuse me, but how do you spend down life insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you don't spend down life insurance. There's an asset limit of, say the asset limit is $3,000. That's countable assets. Your burial fund is not counted. Your burial space items are not counted. You know, all types of assets that are specifically excluded are not counted. So it's just available assets that are not otherwise excluded that you spend down to the asset limit.
Okay. And my second question is not necessarily to you. It's has to do with Section 12, page 9 and 10. And again, it's the 6-month period of eligibility,
in regards to farmers. It's on line 8 on page 10.
Mr. Chair,
this is the record again. I'm getting confused with all the different.
Karen Justo, DHS. Right. With Section 12, this is actually in 2003 the legislature amended Minnesota Care Statute to require a 6-month renewals. So we look at income every 6 months. However, we're still projecting a 12-month dollar figure, and the changes in Section 12, 20, and 23 would align the income calculation with the fact that we look at income every 6 months. So we're not still looking at a projection beyond the next renewal.
And Mr. Chair, that's the point. As a, let's say, crop farmer, beef farmer, they sell their crops, and that's their income for the year. So for 6 months of that year, you might not be eligible because you haven't taken the entire dollar amount that's on their 1040, and
Mr. Chair, Representative, self-employed and farm income is determined based on 1040 income. So we would be looking at their annual income and we would split it in half. We would not be looking at the actual date they sold their stock or anything like that for farmers. Also, I would note that for people who do have seasonal or temporary income, HealthMass is going to determine eligibility for all health care programs at the same time, concurrently. So when folks are on that off-season, they may very well be eligible for medical assistance or another program rather than Minnesota Care. So there's going to be offsets. There's going to be places where a six-month renewal period and six-month income are going to be very beneficial in giving individuals the best health care coverage that they are entitled to at the lowest cost to them.
Representative Mochamba.
Well, Mr. Chair, so you look at the 1040, and that we do those yearly. So it's, let's say, January 1st or January 31st, whatever. But you decide you have to have Minnesota Care in November. And so then do you take the 1040 from the year before?
Please do so.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we generally do that now. If the income has not changed and isn't expecting to change, we look at the previous tax year, regardless of where in the current year an individual or family is applying. And we do that consistently for farmers as well as self-employed.
And then I'm just going to ask you a policy question. And I've gone round and round about this policy for a long time. But I have never really understood why you wouldn't add back your depreciation amounts when it comes to farmers. You have your 1040, you add back your losses, and that we fixed a few years ago. But why can't we add back our depreciation amounts?
Ms. Justo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for self-employed and for farm, we in fact do add back depreciation. For farm, we do not add back net operating loss, and I believe that was a 2003 change, but we do continue to add back depreciation to farm income.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I used the wrong word.
Oh.
Why do we have to add back our reporting, depreciation reporting when every other business in the world, when we look at what our actual growth is after expenses and after depreciation? Why do we change this for small business people and farmers?
Ms. Justo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, adding back depreciation is in fact we're following federal Medicaid law in adding back depreciation. That's how medical assistance also looks at income for self-employed farm. So if we were to not look at depreciation, that in fact would be departing from the Medicaid requirements.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is not Medicaid. This is Minnesota Care. And it's a program for the working person. It's not a Medicare program. And so can you justify it under the fact that it's a program for working individuals?
Mr. Osborne?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Trembo, this is a legislative issue. It's not the issue for this department to determine. It's something that the legislature needs to decide.
And that's right. Thank you.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Powell, I don't think you meant this, but this bill is, I think, much more extensive than we were sold at the beginning of the explanation of this bill. I think it does a number of things to benefit to a number of people, farmers, people in the tourism industry. It makes a number of cuts, and people are not going to be eligible for 6 months out of the year in many, many cases. And it's obviously there's a fiscal impact on this. I think we need to lay this bill over and have some more discussion and get a fiscal note, because there's just too many major changes in this bill, and this is not technical changes that, as we were sold, that the department is already doing and making it be compliant with current law. If the department is already doing these things, then the department is doing them outside of current law. So, because they're pretty substantial changes in a lot of these different sections, I would say this bill is not ready for prime time.
Representative Goodwin, you'll get your wish. This bill is being laid over, actually. So,
oh.
Representative Paul.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, that is the point. And I may agree with Representative Goodwin in some ways, but not for the same reasons. I've also questioned whether there should be some fiscal costs and savings to some of these provisions. But I do agree that that does need a little more discussion. And so we'll discuss it. And it is being laid over for possible inclusion.
For possible inclusion.
Yes. Representative
Thiessen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paul, just on Section 14, what kind of proof do you have to do to show that?
Ms. Justo?
Mr. Chair, Representative?
I'm just real.
Okay. I'll disregard. Thanks.
All right, any further questions or comments? No further questions or comments. Representative Goodwin will get her wish, and Representative Powell will renew his motion to lay over House File 1873 for possible inclusion.
That's not my wish.
You have time to work on it, Representative Goodwin.
One more to go, right?
Yeah, you couldn't hold it, huh? You have to pass.
Representative Bradley, House File 1266 is before us. You have a motion.
Mr. Chair, move House File 1266 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Representative Bradley moves House File 1266 for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. Representative Bradley.
And Mr. Chair, I have two amendments. I have, first of all, move the A1 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the A1 amendment. Representative Bradley, to your amendment.
Yeah, let me explain. Representative Huntley sort of reminded me of this. I asked the intention and the way it works, and this doesn't do anything more than just make it a little bit more clear. The current language in that section could be sort of construed that there's an automatic eligibility for medical assistance. I'm told there's not an automatic eligibility. You are required to still meet the others. But what this does is just simply say that medical assistance may be paid for, if you will, and then it has to meet the criteria, and I double-checked with staff. So let's just make it more clear.
Members, any questions? Representative Huntley?
Just for my information, knowing nothing about the correction system, if they're out on a work release, do they get to keep the money they earn, or what happens to that?
Representative Bradley? Or
Ms. Chair and Representative Huntley, I don't know for sure either. Well, we have somebody who doesn't know.
Someone that might.
This is a wonderful place.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nanette Schrader. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Department of Corrections. And Representative Huntley, to your question, yes, the offender does keep the money that he or she earns on work release. However, you have to remember that they're also responsible for all their housing costs. They may be responsible for their food costs. They may be responsible for transportation. I can tell you that the average wage for our work releasees is probably about $7 an hour.
Representative Huntley, to
so Okay. That's fine.
All right. Any questions or discussions on the A1 amendment? See no further questions or discussion. We'll proceed to vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Bradley also
says. Sure, I'd like to move now the A2 amendment.
Representative Bradley moves the A2 amendment. Representative Bradley to that amendment.
Mr. Chair, this fulfills the promise that I made to the Public Safety Committee, and there may be in continuing work an alternative. My promise was that we would not have any fiscal note that would affect the public safety budget. As this is currently worded, because they may see some additional people that they do have to do discharge planning, there is a potential fiscal note. We are working on an option which might allow us to use medical assistance funds, and if that occurs, then this could come back in our process. But for the time being, I need to remove this because I promised we would not have a fiscal note for public safety.
Any questions or discussions on the A2 amendment? Seeing no questions or discussions, we'll proceed to vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Bradley, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, we've heard this bill before and passed on it, and we just made a couple of minor changes now. We did take I believe there was a section about housing when it was originally before us. We took that section out as well so that it wouldn't have to go to the Housing Committee. What this allows are a couple of things. First of all, it allows the Commissioner of Corrections to get involved in a separate entity for purchasing prescription drugs and allows local governments to participate in that, local jails particularly. We were having a case between local jails and the Department of Corrections where we had a different kind of purchases going on. This is all about mental health bills, or mental health prescriptions, of course. The next thing it does in the next section is designate something called a discharge planner. And that's just somebody that works on helping people make transitions from their incarceration to public. On page 4, at the bottom of page 4, is a change. 30-day supply of their prescriptions is what was previously provided. This suggests that we make that 60 days to provide a little better transition. And, then I think we've already talked about the possibility of being eligible for medical assistance as well. And as I said, those are all sections that this committee has previously reviewed. With that, I stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Goodwin.
Just a quick one, Mr. Chair. You talked about discharge planner in here, and you changed it from designated agent. The people that do the planning and corrections are called caseworkers, or were in the past, and those were the folks who normally did the planning before discharge. Is that changing? Is that changing it to a different person within the prisons who will be doing the plan, the pre-exit planning or pre-discharge planning?
Representative Bradley.
Representative Goodwin, some of the background, Representative Bergman was a party to, and Mr. Connolly, so if you don't mind, I'll have asked Mr. Connolly if he can you speak to that. Or maybe Ms. Schrader will.
Ms. Schrader, for that?
Yep. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Goodwin, the discharge planners are not case managers. They're mostly social workers. This bill passed about, I think, 3 years ago. There was the original statute that passed about 3 years ago that gave us truly discharge planners that work with the mentally ill. And most of them are social workers. They're not the case managers who had been doing that in the past.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions, members? See no further questions. Representative Bradley will renew his motion to lay over House File 1266 as amended for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Service Finance Omnibus Bill. We'll proceed to vote on that. Actually, we won't vote on it. We'll lay it over. Here we go. Lay it over. Fantastic. All right, Representative Bradley, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I gave members a spreadsheet last week and discovered that in playing around with Excel that I had mixed up some numbers and I wasn't getting the right totals. So there's a new spreadsheet in your folders that you're welcome to take. Tomorrow we will be having discussions about ideas for a budget and I don't want to repeat here. I mean, people know what our ground rules and so forth are. It's our intention to complete our work in the morning meeting. I want to be respectful of the range party in the evening so that we can all have a good time in the evening as well. And I believe, I don't think there's anything else. I think that covers what our business for tomorrow is.
All right. See no further business. This meeting is adjourned.